We come to our third and final presentation in this session, which Ross is going to give on behalf of Aaron Braden and, is it Jan or Jan?
Jan
Huttar and Tale Masters. This is coming to us from the Archives of New Zealand, and Ross is currently working on a digital preservation, or he's currently working as a digital preservation analyst, developing digital preservation policy, as well as helping mature their digital preservation capabilities. Fly away down here, Ross, if you wouldn't mind, and we'll get this going. And then I'm certainly looking forward to the panel discussion. I feel I've got more questions than answers now, so.
Thank you for the introduction. For the visually oriented, I'm afraid this is all I've got in terms of slides. I'm going to talk to this paper here in my hands. And there's two names not on here. There's a gentleman called Sean Mosley and a gentleman called Mick Crouch, who are also members of the digital continuity team at Archives New Zealand. And I think the fact their names aren't on here at the moment represents sort of where we were and where we are now in terms of the journey that I'm going to talk about. And we'll come to that later. The other thing I want to talk about is the title itself, Fly Away Home. So my colleague Mick asked me what the hell that meant. And it's in reference to the film Fly Away Home by starring New Zealand's very own Anna Paquin. And it's set in Ontario, Canada, and I think a group of Canadian geese lose their mom or something, and then they can't figure out how to migrate to their country. So she teaches them how to fly, and you can dissect that in a number of ways in terms of what I'm about to talk about. There was a microlight. We're not sure who the geese are and who Anna Paquin is in the relationships that I'm going to describe. The geese could be our team, the digital continuity team, or the geese could be the archives team as a whole, the business, or it could even be the agencies or the larger department that we belong to, the Department of Internal Affairs in New Zealand. So I don't know, maybe you'll have an opinion by the end of this. Like I said, this is kind of a discussion. This is a case study. It's a journey of the beginning of a project, the closure of a project, and then how we're going to pick ourselves up from the closure of that project. And so what we've got is there was a work package created to support a program called the Government Digital Archive Program. 2011 that was created. It was a small work package that was meant to give Archives New Zealand the capability to ingest born digital material. By 2014, on realization that the project wasn't going to deliver the capability to ingest born digital, it was closed down to reevaluate, to look at how we can move forward and create that capability and spend less money, et cetera, et cetera. What it delivered was it did deliver something that we do call the Government Digital Archive, and that the time of writing this contains over 70,000 intellectual entities or digital records, which can be broken down into over 1.8 million individual files. So it was by no means a failure, but it didn't allow us the capability to ingest born digital material. So the project began in 2011, and it was a small work package. There was a hope to ingest material from, I've got five different departments here, places like the Treasury and the Commerce Commission. Born digital records. They were going to be simple transfers. They were going to be diverse transfers. They were going to be unrestricted, so that means containing no private information. And that was how it began. It was meant to deliver business processes, a description of the transfer processes, and among other things. As time progresses, the reality of the actual need to ingest born digital material from, I can't think of a better phrase, but real digital transfers needed to happen. And so, for example, the Canterbury earthquakes, there was a Royal Commission surrounding that, and there was a Pike River coal mine tragedy, and there was a Royal Commission surrounding that. When those commissions closed down, those records need to go somewhere. And traditionally, they come to Archives New Zealand. That's how it works in the paper world. That's how it will work in the digital world. They are not at Archives New Zealand at the minute. As I said, we haven't ingested any born digital material at all yet. During the years 2012, 2013, we were trying to understand how we might take them in. So at the minute, they sit under the custody of DIA Records, Department of Internal Affairs Records team, and they will remain in their custody until we can take them. But the differences with these records are it's just incredible. We've gone from simple potential accessions to we've got two collections. The Pike River collection is over 400,000 files. It contains restricted material, as you might. Same with the Canterbury earthquakes. It contains very private, very sensitive material that is not going to be easy to take. The 400,000 files. Imagine the complexity of things like audio, visual, PowerPoint, and anything you can imagine is in there. And I'll come and speak to that. We worked with these collections, and we worked with a few other collections, such as the White and Matter District Health Board, to try and figure out how digital transfers would happen. And working with these records, it taught us a number of things. Even in the closure of the project, the Government Digital Archive Program, we learned quite a lot. The rest of this paper talks about what we learned. And you can break it down into how the original work package and program maybe didn't have a greater technical angle as it should have done. We can talk about the numbers that are sort of, this is the first time we've got a chance to get our hands on real numbers. Like, this is going to be a real transfer that we will have to take, and we don't know whether it's in the, we don't know whether it's the pointy end of things or if it's in the middle. It's not at the simple end, that's for sure. But what else? We learned about working with agencies and how our expectations were challenged of how agencies might work with us. We can look at working with the business, so even just working internally. So I represent the digital continuity team, but there were half a dozen other teams working on digital transfers. So engaging with those was an interesting thing we learned. And finally, something that might, I don't know how many archivists are in the room or how many people working at archives or libraries are here, but one thing we found is digitization is a distraction. So I'll come to that last as well. Excuse me. So the work packages, when it was first created, again, we said it was going to be simple, unrestricted, small collections that we would learn a lot from. Now, we hope to gain some technical insight. The list of accessions was going to be Archives New Zealand, Private Office of the Prime Minister, the Treasury, the Commerce Commission, and also a site to be decided that had a SharePoint installation. So there was a knowledge that there were going to be issues we're going to face in digital transfers, and I think the hope was that the diversity of this would teach us all of the technical issues we're likely to face moving forward. But when you're trying to create, I think what we learn is when you're trying to create a capability to ingest born digital, you can't do everything at once. And I think the thought is you're going to get a lot of descriptive information out of this. You're going to learn a lot about business processes. But if you look at these from a digital preservation angle, if you take half a dozen files if one collection was just half a dozen files and just one of them was unidentified using tools that we use in the industry, such as Droid, which identifies file formats, then you have to identify that file format. If you have two that are unidentified, then you have to identify that file format. And so the the technical issues you might face are broad and explosive, and you have to think about things from appraisal through to ingest, through to access. And I think we learned it only once we got the numbers. Everything we learned is in hindsight. It was not naive, but yeah, this is what the numbers of real transfers taught us. So if we move on to the numbers, you can see why we learned these lessons and why we learned them fast and hard. The two commissions, the two collections I'll talk to are Canterbury Earthquakes Royal Commission and the Pike River Coal Mine Tragedy. So the numbers we have are, so the Canterbury Earthquakes was 11,000 digital objects with 123 unidentified files, which actually sounds really good. That's just 1% not identified. Pike River, the other thing to note is that was just one content management system, so that was Lotus Notes DMS. Pike River was across two different content management systems. We've got Access Data Summation, which is a evidence browsing platform, and another installation of Lotus Notes. So the Lotus Notes installation contains 24,000 files with 1,254 unidentified. And the Summation collection contains 374,000 files with 3,892 unidentified. We've got things like duplicate objects. We've got 300,000 MD5, pure content-based duplicates across the collection. 4,000, most of them are TIFF files because of the way Summation works. We've got 19 zero-byte objects, which is an interesting one. Two in the Canterbury Earthquakes collection. And across the Canterbury Earthquake Commission, we have 55 unique file formats. And in the Pike River collection, both content management systems, we have 105 unique formats. So you can see that the challenge, there's a challenge that's thrown up at appraisal. How do we take zero-byte file formats? There's a challenge at ingest. How do we find a way to identify 3,000 unidentified objects? And then there's a challenge at access. How do you provide access to 105 different file formats? Now, granted, a lot of them will be things like PDF 1.1 through to 1.7 a couple of hundred times, but there'll be things in there that we don't know about that we need to provide access to. So when you start to think about what we need to do to fill in the gaps that tools like So for those of you who don't know, Droid is a file format identification tool. It keys in on magic numbers within digital file formats. So a famous one is Java class file, which just starts with the bytes in hex, cafe, C-A-F-E-B-A-B-E, cafe babe. And so Droid just reads those and tells you what file format you've got. If it can't identify it, we have to do something to identify it. So, So we think about what we're going to do to fill in the gaps. My naive approach was to set up some Linux scripts. It was going to call tools that we know exist within the digital preservation realm or on Linux that are useful, such as the file utility. We're going to call each one individually across for every single file to output a triage set of data that we can then analyze further to try and see if we've got, to see if it tells us what the file format is, to tell us what other preservation problems we've got. So preservation problems we might have might be password protected files, they might be encrypted files, not always the same thing. And it will tell us what other file formats we've got. So file will tell us what other file formats we've got. There's a tool we use called Ticker that will tell us other file formats we've got. So it's a naive script. You put a file in, or you read a manifest, and you run it across four tools. To run that across 400,000 files, if we just take the Pike River collection, took 49 hours. And this was just to create a triage data set. Ticker is a tool that does identification. It has a /T type identification mode. but it also has a slash M metadata extraction mode. And so one of the reasons we might extract more metadata is to give us more information, obviously. We couldn't run that with the with those four other utilities. So we use one called SHA-1-SUM, ticker type analysis, J-HOVE, and file. Spot that two of them are Java-based, and two of them are C++-based, native to Linux. Ticker, when we use the slash M, the dash M metadata extraction, took 101 hours just to pull out all the metadata it could find from each of those files. And yeah, we still have to take that data set, which is hundreds of megabytes, and pull it apart to look for things like encrypted files and everything else I've just mentioned. So generation of data, pulling these file collections apart, analyzing them just took hours. We did not realize the sheer scale of what we might have to deal with, and we will have to deal with going into the future. What else? Even creating these summary numbers, I can tell you how many files we've got, the size, number of container objects, number of files in containers, total unidentified files, and then other useful breakdowns such as total extension-only identifications and zero-byte files. Droid will tell us most of that, but if you then try analyzing it by hand, you're basically putting it into Excel, you're running a filter, and you're counting the numbers at the bottom of the status bar going, I've got 19 zero-byte objects, note that down on a piece of paper, then put it somewhere else where you can read it. So there's a sort of automation, it takes time, it's not automated, it's Mr. Error prone. So we had to create a tool to do that. It's the moral of the story is we just did not know what we were gonna face, and doing simple, uncomplex, unrestricted collections might not have told us enough. Or indeed, maybe they wouldn't have been uncomplex. Maybe this just told us how complex things could be, whether our intentions were different or not. So what else? We learned that working with agencies was going to be difficult. We had expectations about how things would work. We created a export metadata schema called the transfer metadata file. Within that, you store information about the file, the file names, the relationships between files, the checksums. This would all be generated on export of the files from whatever content management system it was in. So there you've got a situation where you need to work with an IT vendor to do this. So the relationship we had with the agency was, while we're all part of the Department of Internal Affairs, Department of Internal Affairs Records were our client, and Technology Services and Solutions was our shared IT vendor. So it was treated as a business relationship. We didn't all sit in a room together and work together. I guess what we found when we were working with agencies is that everyone was learning. We were talking to technology services. Technology services were talking to DIA records. It was difficult to communicate requirements. Why did we need a checksum? TSS have work across all of the Department of Internal Affairs. They're not preservation specialists. So why do we need this information? How do you communicate the fact we need this information? Now, the records team might know that, but then they might not have the technical ability to understand how or why they're creating stuff as well. TSS were learning how to export from these content management systems and get the metadata from those content management systems and turn them into the metadata that we wanted, the shape that we wanted. And they also had to deal with the volumes. So creating the export metadata schema took, they were running it overnight. We learned things like, they've got other responsibilities, so we haven't got a constant communication thread with any of these teams. If they've got other work to do, we can't just say, oh, we need you to do this and you do it now. There was delays in between what we did. We learned that the tools we developed weren't good enough. So we learned that we had a validation tool based on in Java that would validate the content of the it would validate to a point the content of the export schema. So, but it couldn't tell you if it had invalid values or bad checksums or values in the wrong field. This turned out to be information that only the specialist archives could look at, could validate for themselves, unless we gave both the technology services department or DIO records the same skills. So moving away from how we were working with them, when we pick up the work again in future, we have to think, how will we deal with them? What will we ask them to do, and how ambitious will we be? We worked a lot more closely with the IT vendor than we expected to be. We had two specialists working with them, I said without a constant stream, but when TSS weren't working, our specialists were working to validate the schema, and that took time. And I think we just expected, we'll send something off, we'll send them our requirements, and they'll just do it. But it doesn't work like that, or it didn't for us. What else? So, yeah, other things we learned were digitization is a distraction. Now, this is an interesting one, because I know there's a lot of people doing digitization out there, and I know a lot of people say digitization is not digital preservation. Truth is, well, from our point of view, you can't treat digitization, you can't look at digitization without a digital preservation angle. If you're, well, first of all, it's partially because of the infrastructure we've got. So the digitized material sits in our digital preservation system. One of the reasons it was a distraction was we had a temporary repository in Fedora that we were migrating across to the preservation system. And all future digitized material was going to sit in the digital preservation system as well. Now, it takes two digital preservation specialists to look after that. It takes digital preservation specialists to talk about the file formats that are going to be used to do that, to think about the preservation issues that are going to be in the files that we're going to see ingested. So from the scanners, if you've got TIFFs with invalid tags, or you've got JPEG 2000s that don't validate correctly using JPLISA, they have to go away and deal with that. And so instead of focusing on the Government Digital Archive Program entirely and this work package, they have to work with the other teams to do digitization. But on the plus side, it does help us develop policy. It does help us to learn about the system. It does help us to teach the rest of the organization, well, another part of the organization about the system as well. When the organization says to us, why are you checking for invalid TIFF tags? Or, you know, why is it taking so long? It does give us an opportunity to talk with the organization from that point of view. And any digital preservation knowledge we generate doing digitization informs policy and informs an approach that we'll take on moving forward. Digitization is also what gave us a basic ingest capability with the digital repository system. It's also what gave us basic ingest capability. And so we can move on to how we worked with the business. Engaging with the business, again, we're a department called Digital Continuity. At the minute, we consist of six people. There's two digital preservation analysts, a process administrator, there's a guy who does technology, and then there's two digital preservation analysts, two digital archivists. So there's six of us. We have the technical skills within our team to talk to the rest of the business. The rest of the business, why would we expect them to have the same technical skills? They have other skills. They're archivists. There's people specializing in disposals and acquisitions. There's people specializing in auditing. What we have to do is communicate with the business what we're doing and help them to understand why we're doing it. What we were doing at the time was we were engaging the business. We were engaging with the business too soon. We were taking them on the roller coaster with us. So if we were making mistakes, they were seeing the mistakes. It could cause confusion. When we thought we'd learn a lesson, we'd share the lesson. And if that turned out to be a mistake, it was a mistake the whole business felt. I think one of the things we learned is not to take them on that roller coaster with us. But it's difficult. So one of the examples I've got here is when we were dealing with White Matter Health Board. They had a shared drive of material, and we had to extract that shared drive and get it to archives. So you think, what are we going to do? We're going to get an external hard disk, and we're going to get it across to Archives New Zealand. So you say to the business, we're going to get an external hard disk, or the business says we're going to get an external hard disk. And then you realize it's not that simple. How do you preserve file system metadata? It becomes a research project. So they think you're getting a hard disk, and you have to explain to them why it's not just a matter of looking up a catalog and buying it. You actually have to look at the fact, how are you going to do the file transfer? How are you going to preserve file system metadata? Preservation of the files, you have to understand file system metadata. Then you have to figure out how you're going to preserve it. You're going to have to figure out how to do a cross-file system transfer, what write-blocking equipment will do for you, encryption standards. If this material is, this material just has to be encrypted. It will contain restricted material. And what government-approved encryption standards can we use? So then you have to look up government documentation and research that, because this is the first time we're doing these transfers. This is the first time we're creating new policy. We have to understand encryption and storage techniques. And even at the end of the process, you have to figure out, you have to understand what media sanitization you're going to do. Because when you've got restricted material on a hard disk, you have to get rid of all the forensic evidence surrounding it. So you don't want someone going back in, looking at a disk forensically, and then still pulling out the data. So I'm going to buy a hard disk becomes a research project. And you have to try and feed that back into the business in a sensible way. And they've got, you have to hope they've got the technical understanding. And if they don't, you have to teach them. They've got different milestones and different targets. And they're working more closely with their clients. So it's not just us dealing with the business when we have to communicate this stuff. They have to communicate with their clients. So that's two steps. And if we've got challenges with our business, what challenges are they going to have with the clients? And I guess the summary was, we need concrete lessons. We want to do the learning inside the department now, inside the team, the digital continuity team, the team of six. We want to make fewer mistakes and cause less confusion. But we also appreciate that it's really important to talk to the business. So we talk to them when we think it's diligent. And we tell them the lessons we've learned when we think we've learned them. And hopefully, it just builds for a more solid foundation within the business. And so what are we doing now? So the project closed. And we had some material that was transferred to Archives New Zealand that sat on network storage. And is unmonitored and unmanaged. These are the e-accessions, and they're primarily ministers' papers. We've got manifests and checksums for them, but they need to be put into the digital repository system, the digital preservation system. So now these will become our firstborn digital transfers. So the work starts from the ground up. We've come full circle, and we're doing we're lucky that they are simple, uncomplex transfers. And we're going to build our knowledge using those. Now, to demonstrate how simple they are, we're working with two electronic accessions to begin with. The first one is just 175 files. We've got no container objects, no unidentified files. It's completely known. The other one, e-accession 4, is 1,200 files with... Excuse me. Fizzy water. And we've got two unidentified files. The challenge there is basically, how do I identify those two files? They're not that straightforward. The first accession, we've got duplicate content, but we found that in talking to the business, we can use a disposal authority to get rid of those. So we don't have to go back to the client and say, we want to get rid of your files. They just can be got rid of using policy. With e-accession 4, we've got two unidentified files, but we've also got hidden system files that we can identify. So we've got thumbs.db in there, which is a preview, a file created to preview images when you have thumbnail previews on in Windows. And so we have to think, how are we going to get rid of those? They're not records, or are they? The discussion will happen, and we'll see what happens. And we're developing processes. We're not developing a process. We developed a process diagram and presented it to business the other week. But the process diagram doesn't represent how we'll do all future digital accessions. It represents how we'll do these two accessions. It's a very straightforward process. Throughout it, we've got a technical angle. So throughout it, we're always aware of the technical challenges. We're kind of doing a technical reappraisal. So we're doing a technical reappraisal. We're distilling the collections into something that we're going to ingest. When we get to ingest, we're aware of any validation or identification issues. And I think that's the point when basically the technical angle disappears a bit more, and then it will just go straight through to the digital repository. But we're keeping an eye on things technically throughout the process, which is something that was lost. We are developing small and ambitious process documentation surrounding that, so like the diagram just for the two accessions that can be built on when we get the next accession. So we've got a process diagram for two accessions. The next one comes along, and it will evolve that way. Yeah, iterative learning. Evidence-based learning. So if something doesn't work this time, we'll figure out how to fix it the next time. And it will inform future documentation, future systems requirements. So one of the compromises we've got at the minute is our catalog system can't describe these as well as we would have liked, as well as the Government Digital Archive Program would have let us do. But we've compromised, and we've got a way of working around that. And we'll ingest it, we'll see how it works for the archivists, and if it doesn't work for the archivists, we'll use that to tell the business we need more capability. And they can then say, well, okay, we can see why you need that capability and hopefully build it for us. Anyway, so we're coming to a close. I've got some summaries. What we've learned, we can't tackle every problem at the same time. The work scope of the original work package was too broad. We must focus on one problem at a time. We must focus on fewer accessions at a time, and iterative learning is paramount. Evidence-based approach is required to make decisions, and we must do the simple things well. We must share with the business, but we mustn't work in a bubble, and we must seek feedback and test assumptions, but we must do that in a concrete way. What we need is a plan for future Royal Commissions to reduce potential issues in future. One of my colleagues has this idea about a Royal Commission in a box. So you decide what your content management system is going to be and the metadata you need to keep and the file formats that you might allow, for example. Tools to support the work required from agencies. Optimize tools in our basic toolkit. And better support for technical appraisal alongside archival appraisal. Now, in Welsh and the team at Victoria University are helping with some of those tools, so hopefully that will help us moving forward. And I've got a conclusion here, and I'll read it straight from here. So asked recently, what about the influx of digital formats that we're expecting? It is clear that we have instincts about what we're likely to face in the future, but the temptation previously has been to wait for a system to be developed to handle the influx, all of the time putting the past on hold a little longer. Just a little longer. The results could potentially be dangerous. We may be left with unmonitored, unmanaged files sitting outside of a digital preservation system, files which cannot be delivered to the public easily. Instead of focusing on the future, we can build for the future by doing our housekeeping, looking at these older accessions and using them to build our understanding of what we might do with the stuff we might receive. We have this material in our hands now, and we can't predict the future just yet. So that's that.
Thanks, Ross. Amply demonstrating the value of a pilot project, I think we can all agree. I'll invite the speakers up to the table and open the floor for questions.